So we're in a summer series now. Jesus, champion of faith, and all taken from the area of Hebrews, Hebrews 11 mainly, and the first two, three verses of Hebrew 12, which talks about this huge cloud of witnesses to the life of faith. They're not heroes at all, not by any stretch of the imagination. And we're highlighting some of these people that are listed in Hebrews 11 and beyond outside of that, and showing they're real people like us, real people. They're not, they don't wear halos, right? They're not that. And how, because of their faith, because they full weight on God, on Jesus, what God did through them. And so that's what we're doing. They're just different Sundays that throughout this summer, that's what we're focusing on. And so this Sunday, we have Marilla to come and share with us on one of those people. So, Marilla, great to have you here. And looking forward to what you got to say.
Awesome. Good morning. Before I start, I want to do a little disclaimer. Kids have left the sanctuary with Jeff, but if you have kids at home, there's going to be some mature content this morning. So if you don't want to answer a bunch of questions, you might want to find your kids an alternate activity. I'm just saying. All right, Scott just said these people we're not talking about today, or the people we're talking about, are not heroes, but they have been called heroes of the faith. And what is a hero? They're not perfect, but they are people who inspire us with their actions, their character, their integrity. And today we're going to talk about Rahab, a prostitute. So how does that fit? How can a prostitute be a champion or a hero? When we hear that word in our society, it comes with a lot of assumptions that this person engaging in this particular vocation is probably morally bankrupt. They're probably hypersexualized, evidently broken, or they're just somehow skewed and their objective is to seduce and corrupt honorable individuals. So what is it that a prostitute can teach us about faith, about how we should live our lives? Well, let's take a look at Rahab's story. So according to historians, it probably happened around the Bronze Age. I'm not a historian, but from what I can gather, that's about 1300, 1400, 1500 BC. And the Israelites have just been wandering in the desert for 40 years. Moses has finally passed away, and the mantle of leadership has been passed on to Joshua. And God says, okay, Joshua, it's time now. It's time to get yourself some land. Time to settle down and stop wandering. So Joshua sends two spies out into Jericho. They're supposed to take a look around, kind of check out the lay of the land. And so they go, enter into the city, and somehow find themselves at Rahab's house. Some people suggest maybe it's for lodging. There was one cheeky individual that suggested maybe they were there to avail themselves of her services. We don't know. We just know that they landed there. And again, the story's never totally complete. We don't get everything. So we don't know what went on between Rahab and these two guys, what they talked about, you know, what was going on. But we do know that the king hears that there's some spies. And so he sends out his guys to Rahab's house. They come knocking on the door. They're like, hey, Rahab, we heard a couple guys were here. And she says, oh, yeah, but they're gone. They were here. They wanted to slip out before the gates of the city closed. They went that way. If you hurry, you can catch up with them. So they do. They take off, start looking for these guys. But we know that Rahab has hidden these guys up on the roof under big piles of flax. And so after the king's men leave, she goes up onto the roof, and we're going to pick up the story there. So this is in Joshua 2:8-16. So before they went to sleep, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that dread of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt in fear before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. As soon as we heard it, our hearts failed, and there was no courage left in any of us because of you. The Lord your God is indeed God in heaven above and on earth below. Now then, since I have dealt kindly with you, swear to me by the Lord that you in turn will deal kindly with my family. Give me a sign of good faith that you will spare my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." The men said to her, "Our life for yours. If you do not tell this business of ours, then we will deal kindly and faithfully with you when the Lord gives us the land." So Rahab is smart enough to know who's going to win this. She's heard all about what God has done, and she believes that he is going to win this. And so she's buying herself an insurance policy here. So I'll help you if you promise that my family and I are going to be spared. And the spies are like, "Yep, we'll do this. Got to make sure that everyone's in your house, because if they're not in your house at the time that we come in, we can't guarantee. If they leave your house, we can't guarantee that they're going to be safe. If you tell anyone, we don't have to honor our word." So they give her this red cord that she ties in her window. And then she lowers them down through the window out to the outside of the wall, and they take off. Now, it makes you wonder, like, how big was this basket that she had laying around to get these guys down? Like, was this something that she did regularly, that she could kind of work it out? Maybe there's a history of shady guys showing up at her door, right? And that's how the king knew to go there, to send his guys there. That's how she knew how to get them out the window. Who knows? It's all speculation. So they take off. She says, "Oh, go to the mountains for 3 days. And then when the king's men come back, then go see your people." So that's exactly what they do. They go back to Joshua and say, "Yep, we're good. We're good to go. But we've made this covenant with Rahab, and we have to save her family." Joshua's like, "Hey, no problem. We got this." So then we get this battle of Jericho, right? Where they're walking around the city 6 days. And on the seventh day, blow the trumpets, yell, the walls come tumbling down. And sure enough, there's that red rope in the window, and Rahab's family is saved. So in Joshua 6:25, "But Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, Joshua spared. Her family has lived in Israel ever since, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho." So I don't know when Joshua was written and if Rahab's descendants are still living with Israel, but yeah, probably. So what can we learn from Rahab and from this story? Later on in James, the writer of James talks about Rahab. She shows up again. Says, "In the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction?" So James uses the word prostitute and righteous in the same sentence. That might make some of us uncomfortable. It's not really, like, when we think of people engaged in prostitution, righteous is probably not the first word that comes to mind. And so we might be feeling a little bit of cognitive dissonance. Something does not sit right here. So those of us on this side of the history often want to step in and sanitize Rahab a little bit. She wasn't really a prostitute. She was an innkeeper. They ended up at her house because she was an innkeeper. And some of that has to do with whether your translation says she lives in the wall or on the wall, because apparently there was some sort of class difference there. I even read a rabbi who suggested that after all of this happened with Jericho, that Rahab actually married Joshua. I don't know. We don't know. What we do know is that somehow she retained this title, prostitute. kind of suggests that, you know, maybe she carried on. I know, it sounds scandalous, doesn't it? So why are we compelled to sanitize Rahab? Why do we need to clean her up? Because we feel like maybe we need to help God a little bit. We can't, like, it kind of brings him down if he relates to these kind of people, right? What are these kind of people? What are those people, those others? Well, let's take a look at what may have been Rahab's history. We don't know. There's nothing that kind of gives us her history. But let's take a look at it historically. I did a real quick kind of survey. So Cana or Jericho was, like I said, historians think it was around the Bronze Age in Mesopotamia, which is the area where the Tigris and the Euphrates River meet and all of the surrounding area. Maybe that means nothing to you. Not so much to me, but if you want to know, that's where it is. And in the society at that time, prostitution was not necessarily looked at as negatively as we look at it now. It was a class-based society, and women were basically uneducated and relegated to the domestic sphere, so taking care of children, managing the household. And in terms of societies at that time, it was a little progressive because women could own property, they could enter into contracts themselves, they could have a job. But in the grand scheme of things, their fathers still chose their spouses. They had very little autonomy and power. The husband could tell you in an instant, I divorce you, and you'd be divorced. Women could sort of start the process of divorce, but they needed to prove adultery or abuse, which we know even these days is hard to do. So if they did work, they were generally paid half of what a man was paid. So they don't get to choose who they're married to. If they make their husband angry, they could be instantly divorced. They get paid half of what men get paid. It doesn't sound like a very stable and secure sort of position to be in. And there were two types of prostitution at that time. There was sacred prostitution and secular prostitution. And sacred prostitution was temple prostitutes. So they would engage in orgies for festivals or sort of spiritual reasons. And then your plain old brothel prostitute. Young girls could be sold into sacred prostitution by their family, sold to the temple. And some of them could end up as priestesses, but I'm going to guess that that was for the elites. And some of those priestesses could wield a bit of power, but that wasn't the norm. And I guess if you asked the girls sold into prostitution, I imagine that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily be thrilled about it, even though in that particular society, it wasn't necessarily looked down on. Just the nature of the work is pretty heartbreaking. And to be sold by your family. And then there would be a whole bunch of other class issues and financial issues, reasons that women ended up in prostitution. So even though it wasn't considered maybe as, undignified as it is nowadays, it still would have been a really difficult life, regardless of how they ended up and what it was, whether it was sacred or secular. So I think it's safe to assume that since Rahab found herself in this line of work, that she had faced some sort of challenges in her life that necessitated her career choice. I think it's safe to assume that Rahab's life was pretty messy. So now I'm going to ask you to step into the land of metaphor with me for a minute. Imagine that in our lives, at the beginning of our life, we are given a goal, we're given a mission. And that mission is to knit a sweater. This is our life goal. We're going to knit a sweater. I just saw Scott's face like, what? Track with me here. So everyone lines up at the beginning of their life. They're going to get their resources. And imagine Rahab, she's in line and she's like, okay, I got to knit this sweater. I'm going to get my stuff. I'm going to get started. And she sees the people before her getting up to the front of the queue and they're getting their resources. So we got, okay, you're going to knit your sweater. Here's your instruction, your pattern. We got some needles for you. You got two, everything you need. You're going to need a measuring tape. Make sure you're on track with your stitches. I know not all of you are knitters. Neither am I. I'm just a wannabe. And here's your yarn. Nice, neat ball of yarn. So Rahab's getting to the front. She's like, awesome, here we go. And she gets up to the front. She says, Rahab. The person goes, okay, Rahab, awesome. Here's your one needle and your yarn. And she goes, what? I can't knit with one needle. And my yarn's all messy. Why don't I get a pattern and what everyone else gets? And the person at the front of the queue says, well, your resources are determined by the generations before you, by the resources they had and what they decided to do with their resources. I'm sorry, this is what is here for you. This is what is available for you. So before Rahab even starts her mission, she's got to do some pre-work. While other people are learning how to maneuver their needles, they're learning how to read their pattern, they're learning their stitches. Maybe, you know, at the beginning, they knit when they should have purled or they're having trouble. And maybe they drop a few stitches. They got to go back and take out a few rows. But in no time, they're off and running. They're knitting their sweater. Some people even have other people beside them to show them how to read the pattern, how to do their stitches. Rahab has to start by untangling her yarn. Can't even find an end here. How am I going to do this? When I untangle my yarn, I have to go looking for another needle? I hope it matches, because you know, if you knit with two different size needles, it's going to end up wonky. This is a metaphor for our lives. Some of us begin life with most of the resources that we need, with people beside us to teach us how to walk through life, help us build the skills. Some of us are handed this. And we look at the other people and think, oh, why am I not as far ahead as they are? Why am I not as spiritual? Why am I not as put together as everyone else? They started at a different point. We all start at a different point. Some of our beginnings are neat. Some of them are messy. Some of them start neat, end up messy. Everybody's journey is different. But those of us that have messy yarn sometimes believe that we are counted out from the kingdom, that we aren't worthy for God to use us, to work through us. We can't possibly be helpful until we clean up our yarn. So I can just picture God in heaven. So he's looking down. He's like, okay, these spies need somebody who's going to have their back. And there's some angels going, well, what about this person? You know, they're highly regarded in the city. What about this person? They have everything together. Look at their sweater. It's looking really good. And God goes, no, 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 we're going with Rahab. And the angels are like, what? Rahab? She hasn't even untangled her yarn yet. And God goes, no worries. There's time for that. The one thing she has going for her is she's willing. She's ready. She's ready to partner with me right now. She gets it. She knows what's going on. We can take care of the yarn later, but she's ready right now. Now, this isn't new. Most of us have probably heard this. We need to be open and willing to, you know, hear God's word and what's going on right now. But I think a lot of us add a qualifier onto that. Okay, I got to be willing, and I have to have my crap all put together. Willing, and I got to be at this certain point in life. I have to have read my Bible through the whole time, once fully. I have to, I got to be here. I got to be there. I got to be on the worship team. I got to be doing this. God says, no, all you got to be is willing. We'll take care of the rest later. Some of us have been taught to believe that God is expecting an equality of outcome. So wherever you start, you got to get to the same point before he's going to use you, before he's going to be pleased, before he's going to accept you. I can't believe that if my God is a compassionate God. I work every day with people whose stories would break your heart. And for some, just getting up in the morning, showing up for our families, going to work, just getting through the day takes everything we have, because the rest of our energy is being used to try to untangle our history and the things that have been passed down to us. We didn't ask for this mess, but this is what we've got. And so God can't be compassionate and expect equality of outcome. When he looked down and said, okay, we're going to use Rahab, he didn't say, we're going to use, or I don't think he said, we're going to use Rahab the prostitute. He just said, Rahab, my daughter. She's just Rahab. He didn't define her through her circumstances and what was going on. He defined her by her heart. That's how he looks at us. Not at our circumstances, not at our mess, but at who we are and our heart. I believe that when we get to heaven, some of us are going to have a beautiful sweater. It is going to be knit perfectly according to pattern. It is going to be gorgeous. And God is going to say, that is amazing. Look at what you did. This is an amazing sweater. Some of us have spent a lot of our lifetime unraveling our mess. And so maybe we only got half our sweater done. And when we get there, one sleeve is longer than the other. There are a couple holes because we dropped stitches. And you know what I believe God's going to say? That's awesome. You did a great job.
Perfect fit.
Perfect fit. And when, or if we show up, our yarn is still messy because it was a really big mess. You know what I think he's going to say? Good job. That is awesome. Look at that big mess you started with, and look how much you unraveled. Way to go. Most of us are not going to end up helping a nation establish themselves. But we can partner every day in the little things if we're willing. Matthew 24:40, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. A listening ear, a compassionate heart, meeting an immediate need if we have the resources for that. We can partner with God every day in the little things, even if we're still untangling our yarn. He doesn't judge us by how messy or how neat our yarn is. He looks at our heart. So I'm just going to wrap up with a quote by an author named Deborah Hirsch. I read this a couple weeks ago and it just kind of stayed with me, and I hope that there's something in here for each of us. So each and every one of us, and on every level, ought to be moving closer toward the ideals of God. It's about the movement. That's what happens when we partner with the Holy Spirit and experience the inner work of renewal within us. Each of us, wherever we are at in our discipleship, no matter what the issue, with the help of the Holy Spirit, continues to step into greater kingdom living. That's what it is to bring a little heaven, a little of heaven to earth. Are we willing to move towards the ideals of God? Are we willing to stay open and partner with him to bring a little heaven to earth? That's all he asks. So we're going to take a minute. I'll invite you to just sit for a minute with the words. If there's something that resonated with you, just kind of hang on to that. And just prepare ourselves to go into the week with the intention of moving closer to the ideals of God, with the intention of staying willing and seeing how we might be able to bring a little heaven to earth.